We are in the middle of a series called Half True, in which we're looking at some of the subtle lies both Christians and culture believe. They're the kind of lies that you kind of think, but hang on, isn't that a verse in the Bible? You know, like, God won't ever give you more than you can handle. Or, God helps those who help themselves. Or the one we're looking at today, I must be true to myself. Surely that's in the Bible somewhere, hey? I can see some of you already nervously flipping through your NIVs thinking, to thine self be true. Isn't that a verse in Proverbs somewhere? But it's not there. That was actually said by Shakespeare. And looking for it is a bit like my son Charlie, who loves his Where's Wally books, looking for an object that I've told him exists on that page that does not exist. That's a half-truth that I sometimes play with my children just to get 10 minutes of peace and quiet. So that is him really looking for a dog on that page that doesn't exist. Just like us looking through our Bibles for these half-true verses. So although we won't find this sentiment in the Bible, I think you'll agree that it is pervasive. It's deep in the culture that we swim in, and it's deep in each of us. This preoccupation with ourselves and being true to ourselves. And yet, it's a half-truth. And a half-truth is basically just a lie dressed up in sheep's clothing, really. It might look a bit friendlier, but it's just as deadly in the end. So I'd like to begin by just showing us how pervasive this thought and this belief is in our lives and in our world. And then I'd like to show how the gospel informs this view and actually contradicts it. Now, if you're here and you're not a follower of Christ, this might be one of the core objections that you have towards faith and Christianity even. This, you might believe, as much of the world and culture do, that you being true to yourself is the highest truth and virtue. And any form of restraint or someone trying to define that or in any way guide that, any religion or ideology that seeks to change or define you at your core is regressive and repressive. And my hope is that as we delve deeper into what we're looking at today, you'll come to see that there is a fundamental difference between who you truly are and who you think you are. And in the meantime, I hope you'll know that you're welcome here, that we are not all in exactly the same space as we meet here today. We're awash with different fears and joys and doubts and hopes and longings and growing faith. There are bruised reeds amongst us and strong trees and brand new sprouts and smoldering wicks of faith. And we are all welcome here, no matter where we find ourselves on our spiritual journey. Now back to this half-truth that we're looking at today. I must be true to myself. As I said, Shakespeare said it in his play Hamlet, and it's an unquestioned tenet of our day. Most of us were raised on it, really, along with our mother's milk, and it sunk in deeper with every Disney movie that we watched. Now more than ever, we finish school and embark on a mission to not just find a career, but on an interior quest to find ourselves. It's an interesting concept that's quite novel in society, this idea of going out to find oneself. It suggests that there is an essential part of us that's been lost, hey? And that it's up to us, through some deep effort, to find or regain this essential self, this part of ourselves. And if we agree and we commit to this pursuit, it often ends up being a lifelong pursuit, this looking for our true selves. Because like grabbing a hold of a crashing wave or trying to hold on to sand that's running through your fingers, our selves are perpetually changing, aren't they? And eluding us. Just when we think we understand ourselves, something in us happens or something happens around us that makes us realize we don't completely get it. Elizabeth Gilbert, a non-Christian author who's had a huge influence on modern society, having penned the book Eat, Pray, Love, says this,
Yesterday, I might have been a glorious monument to somebody. True enough. But tomorrow, I could be a fireworks depository. One must always be prepared for riotous, endless waves of transformation. That's the culture that we live in. It's this commitment to find your truest self and this acknowledgement that your truest self is a riotous, endless wave of transformation. It's like trying to catch a hold of a wave. So it turns out, as elusive as ourselves may be, broadly speaking, our culture believes that our most important work is to find our authentic self. We're told that this is where our greatest freedom lies, to define ourselves and then to express authentically who we are. To fail to do this is to have failed at life. Coupled to this modern belief is an increasing conviction that humans are inherently good. So working off this assumption, the highest good is individual freedom and happiness, surely, and self-determination and definition and expression. Can you see how they go hand in hand? Traditions, religions, received wisdom that's been passed down, any regulations and social ties that restrict this highest good must be discarded and destroyed. Forms of external authority are rejected while being true to oneself is celebrated. This kind of thinking, this preoccupation with self, has only recently become mainstream, by the way. In 2006, our self-orientation had become so fixed that finally even Time magazine had to recognize it. And you know who had named as its person of the year? You. And this all before the term selfie was even coined. Speaking of selfies, have a look at this picture. It's a picture of a crowd in a UK town called Coventry. It accompanied an article I read about Coventry being voted not only one of the most unhappy places to live, but also in a separate survey, one of the most selfie obsessed. Coincidence? So although recently popular again, where did this idea of being true to oneself as our highest ideal and goal in life come from? And why does it sound so close to the gospel? The answer is Gnosticism. In 1945, at Nag Hammadi, some ancient scrolls were discovered. And they were discovered pertaining to the Gnostic Gospels, which was a Christian sect that started 200 years after Christ. For 200 years thereafter, it was kind of beside Christianity, and the early church had to fight against its ideas of the self being deified, because it seemed so close to the Gospels. And yet, just like small degrees in change, when you start out, you might be starting from the same place, saying Jesus is a wonderful man. But when there's tiny degrees in your angles, you end up in very different places. The Gnostic Gospels were written by a small group of people who liked Jesus a lot, but they reinvented him. The essential message of the Gnostics was that Jesus came to help us find our true selves. The same way Jesus understood that he was the Son of God and the light of the world, so he came to help us understand that we are like him. We only need to look within ourselves to find the divine spark, says Gnosticism. But this is something very different to original Christianity. The individual in the Gnostic understanding was not a child of God, but rather contained the potential to be God. Gnosticism moved the authority from the seat of God to the seat of our own soul. But in Orthodox Christianity, God came down to save us. We don't ascend through enlightenment and higher thinking to become him. And yet today you can see these fault lines and these strands of thinking in so much of New Age spirituality. At the same time, we live in a world that has large pockets that are called post-Christian. Make no mistake, Christianity is still exploding. Statistics say that in the next 2 decades, it is set to grow from 31% of the world's population to 33%. It's not in decline. Yet in certain pockets of society, particularly elite academic pockets of society, Christianity is on the decline. It's being discarded. So where does society go after Christianity? It can't go back, say the academic elite. It must go forward. The progression then looks like this. And I got this from Mark Sayers. We lived in a pre-Christian world where there was the worship of gods. Then we went through a Christian era, the worship of God. And now a post-Christian era, the worship of self. He says it like this. Before the spread of Christianity, society lived in the tyranny of many gods that were unpredictable. We tried to appease them. Then the gospel of Jesus came and taught that there was but one God and we need worship him. But what about now? If we discard Christianity, where do we go? We can't go back to the chaos. Then what? The only cult that can truly thrive in the aftermath of Christianity is a narrow service of self. For the remainder of my message, I'd like to critique this seemingly unquestioned self-preoccupation of our time, this narrow service of self. But first, I want to affirm one very important thing, and that's that honesty is very important. So is our embracing our God-given individuality. That's biblical. Being true to oneself is essential, if by it we mean living honestly by what we know to be true. There is a very essential inward focus season in our lives, too, that happens as we grow as humans, particularly in our adolescent years when we begin to define ourselves and separate ourselves from our parents and their identity. I'm reminded of my son Charlie, who sometimes says to me, "You're not the boss of me." there's a key self-identity that is important to find and be focused on for a while in our lives. It's healthy and it's part of God's design. Also, I'm not saying that the deception in this half-truth is that self is bad. We are created in God's image and we are wonderfully and fearfully made. We are each masterpieces, Romans tells us, prepared in advance to do unique, good things in our lives. We do need to know what we want and who we are. We do need to be honest, and we do need to have the courage to express ourselves. But what I want to address today is how we're in danger of not just recognizing and celebrating ourselves, but deifying them. Of unquestioningly thinking being true to ourselves is most important, that finding ourselves will somehow save us. We'll see how the swing towards the self has a lot of encoded ideas that are counter-gospel, and that only the gospel can truly liberate us from them. And make no mistake, we do need to be liberated from this half-truth, from this perpetual self-absorption. Just look at that selfie pic again. That's not life in abundance, is it? It reminds me of the dude who was the original selfie-obsessed guy. In Greek mythology, Narcissus was a hunter known for his beauty. Once having gotten thirsty after hunting, he leans over a pool of water to drink and he catches sight of his amazing reflection. Not realizing it's merely his own reflection, he falls in love with it. And unable to leave the allure of it, he eventually drowns in it. That's Narcissus. Now, you might spurn the idea of selfies and tut-tut the youth of today that take selfies, but don't be too quick to let yourself off the hook. There's an inward bent of self-absorption in all of us, and it comes out in a number of ways. The half-truth is that the ultimate goal in life is self-actualization, and it's deep-seated in all of us. So what can we do? How can we hope to get properly aligned, to stretch out and be unbent instead of turning in on ourselves? Tim Keller says to find ultimate freedom, we need to find the freedom of self-forgetfulness. In a book by the same title, he elaborates and says that our preoccupation with ourselves has two apparent paradoxical outworkings. We either are quite proud and think more of ourselves than we should, like narcissists, or on the opposite side of the spectrum, we can really struggle with our self-esteem and think less of ourselves than we should. He says both of these symptoms come from the same toxic well, a heart that has not yet fully been changed to the gospel and unbent from looking in on itself to God, the source of all light and truth. This is a quote from him and his book. The essence of the gospel is not thinking more of myself or less of myself. It's thinking of myself less. So in light of this, let's look at five ways the gospel dismantles and deals a death blow to this half-truth. This half-truth that our ultimate allegiance should be bowed to our own true selves. Firstly, the gospel starts with God, not us. Genesis 1 verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The Bible doesn't start with, in the beginning, we created ourselves. But in the beginning, God. The Gnostics were quite simply wrong to assert that we are gods hidden in the mess of matter. No, God is the creator, and we get to be the created. We are God's creation, not our own. Any belief that primarily esteems ourselves as creators rather than creatures is just simply out of sync with basic reality. The best-selling book by Rick Warren, The Purpose-Driven Life, opens with this sobering reminder. It is not about you. And this is truly liberating, to exit the self-imposed room full of mirrors that we tend to live in, that can become like a toxic prison, and to discover that there are endless landscapes to look at, horizons as wide as the eye can see. It's a wonderful world when we start to forget ourselves and realize that there is more than a room full of mirrors. When we look up from our screens and selfies and find that the world does not begin and end with us, that's true freedom. Secondly, the gospel shows us that we are not gods, but rather fallen and fallible. We can go back to the second century Gnostics to track the origins of this modern self-centered mindset, but actually we can go back even further to the Garden of Eden. Genesis 3 shows us the original temptation that befell our first parents, and it's the whispered promise of Satan that he still whispers to each of us. Genesis 3 verse 4, when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will become like God, knowing good and evil. You see, this move towards a Gnostic greater self-actualization always promises so much, doesn't it? It feels so enlightening to discover more about ourselves and to look deep and unlock things about ourselves. We can begin to think that if we could only get to the bottom of our true selves, there we will find ultimate enlightenment. But when we embark on these inner voyages of self-discovery, absent from our Creator and His guidelines for our lives, as Eve did, we enter a foggy haze, as she did. Once you believe the serpent's lies, you don't see more clearly. Your thinking becomes more hazy and more distorted. The Gnostic language of seeking and self-discovery seems to promise a life of pleasure and enlightenment, but in reality, it imprisons us. To reject our creatureliness and to try usurp God's throne, to be the authors of our own lives without reference to the Creator, is not freedom, it's imprisonment. Leanne Payne is a prominent Christian author, and she speaks of us all being, and I've referred to it already, bent in on ourselves, like Gollum, misshapenly bent in preoccupied with our shadows and what we find when we turn away from the sun, from the source of all enlightenment and real light and truth, which is God. But we were always designed to be straightened out with our gaze not on ourselves, but on God. Eve, our collective mother in the Garden of Eden, apparently had everything she needed, including a face-to-face relationship with her Creator. But when her will, herself, her desires clashed with his will, she bit into the forbidden fruit. And at its essence, that bite represented her placing herself and her desires at that moment above God and his will for her life. If you'd asked Eve then, mid-bite, what she was doing, she might have said, "I am being true to myself." And like every human since Eve, who was bent in on that moment, we've all done that. Been far more occupied on ourselves and our quest for being true to ourselves than God and his revealed truth and face. One modern day sociologist, a secular sociologist, notes that accompanying our increasing autonomy and freedom seems to be a greater personal fragility. We are more open and mobile, fluid and socially independent, but also more volatile and destabilized than ever. The author Francis Spafford writes, We are beings whose wants make no sense. They don't harmonize. Whose desires deep down are discordantly arranged so that you truly want to possess and you truly want not to at the very same time. You're equipped for farce or even tragedy more than you are for happy endings. Wow, what a twist in the story of our lives. All this time, if you've been listening to movies and lyrics of our day, we've been led to believe that if we just follow our hearts, we'll find truth and freedom. But it turns out the compass needle there is as faulty as an Eskom power plant. Under the power of sin, our inner compass needle keeps moving, spiraling this way and that, unpredictably swinging, pointing for a minute toward true north being this way, and then the next that way. If you look into your heart to find your deepest desires, you certainly will discover many things about yourself, but over time, you will discover something else, that some of your desires completely contradict one another. All these centuries later, we join the cry of Jeremiah the prophet. The heart is deceitful above all things. Who can truly know it? Least of all, take directions from it. The gospel informs us that we are fallen and fallible. Thirdly, the gospel bestows on us a new self. In traditional societies, a few decades ago even, we would live into the identity others gave us. In our modern society, we tend to say, "I don't care what you say about me. The truth about me is what I say it is." But there are massive problems with both approaches, aren't there? Because when it comes to our identity, there's the you that others think you are, there's the you that you think you are, and there's the you that God thinks you are. And they are three very different versions, aren't they? Yet only one of them can be true. Only one of these is unchanging. And that's the beauty and power of the gospel. It gives us a new self, a rock-solid, unchanging identity, bestowed upon us by sheer grace, not from our enlightenment, from a God who delights to show you not only who he is, but who you are in him. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 17, "If anyone is in Christ, the new creation has come, the old has gone, and the new is here." In reflecting on this idea of self, theologians speak of us having two selves, a base self and a redeemed self, a fallen self and a resurrected self, an old self and a new self. Both are you, but they have very conflicting desires, don't they? Both are you, but one, theologically speaking, is more you-ier than you. It's the one you were created to be, the best redeemed version of you, not the base version, the enlivened, enlightened version, not the depraved, distorted version. And that's why when we train our kids, we can say, Sammy, don't hit your brother. That's not who you are. Of course, in that moment, he was being very true to himself and his desires. But that's not who God created Sammy to be, a guy that's vengeful and hitting his brother. Be true to the better self, not the baser self. I've titled this point that the gospel bestows us with a new self. But thinking about it, it's not just that the self is new. Perhaps it's the oldest version of ourselves. It's the original factory-designed version of ourselves. Only possible once the ruach, breath of God's spirit, enlivens it again. As we continue to live saying, not my will, but your will be done. The gospel bestows on us a new self. It's a better self. It's a truer self. Fourthly, the gospel makes us other-centered. If you read the Gnostic Gospels, written, as I said, long after Jesus lived, and compare them with the true Gospels, one of the key differences is that the true Jesus calls us to an other-centered life, a life of love and humility, of sacrifice and service, while the reinvented Gnostic Jesus is all about personal fulfillment, looking within. Mark 10, verse 43, Jesus said, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Our society tells us to find our true selves at all costs, but Jesus tells us to die to ourselves. Now, individuality is good, but individualism, this commitment to our self-interests, is not good. It breaks community and it breaks people. In the modern approach, if a relationship is satisfying to you, you keep it as long as it's pleasing. It's well documented that under these conditions of our modern individualistic society, social ties and institutions like marriage and family are eroding, they're weakening, and society is fragmenting as a result. A kind of light version of this played out in my own life was when I was 16 and I had my first boyfriend, and I fell madly in love with him. And we dated for 3 weeks. And it was amazing. I remember he was at a nearby boarding school, and I would write the whole conversation we were going to have on a piece of paper before we had it. And then he would phone, and I would know exactly what I was going to say. You know, those kind of relationships. It wasn't very deep or profound. And he invited me to his matric dance. I was so excited to go. And just a few days before, I started to feel a bit off about this guy. And all those infatuation feelings turned. I'm sure we've all had this at some point in our lives. A friend of mine, Hilda, calls it the sip moment, where someone does one small thing, but you go, oh no, it's over. We could never be together. For Hilda, it was when a guy said that she was deeply in love with. He said, can you pass me the sip instead of soup? And she knew it could never be. And Gareth had done something similar. He had taken me to a movie, and I'd offered to pay, and he'd said, "No, no, my mom gave me extra." And I knew that it was over. He was dead to me. And so, because he was at boarding school, I didn't see him that often, and he came to pick me up for his matric dance, and he was a wonderful boy. I mean, young man. And I just knew I needed to be true to myself. And so right then, as we sat down at his matric dance table, and he was in his gleaming hired tux, and I was in my, you know, dress that I'd got made, he said, are you all right? And I said, no, I think we should break up. And he cried at that table, and I remember thinking, well, I'm just being true to myself. And that's such a small version. I really have grown up a lot and died 1,000 days thinking about that in my life. But it's a small version of what we all do in life if we're just thinking that that's our highest truth, is to be true to ourselves in any moment. We destroy and we build, we tear down far more than is necessary. I'm not saying I should have stuck with Gareth, but certainly I should have stuck it out for that night, or at least until the end of the dinner. See, this commitment to self leads down a road with an unexpected destination. In C.S. Lewis's work, The Great Divorce, Lewis imagines hell as a boring English town, populated by souls unaware of their own damnation, who, in their attempts to find autonomy and freedom, move further and further and further away from each other, pushing individualism all the way to utter isolation, disappearing into narcissist's pool of self-obsession in the end. The gospel trains us, though, to not be self-centered and, as a result, isolated, but other-centered. And fifthly, the gospel calls us to be God-centered. When it comes to how we live, what is our value grid? Let's compare the gospel of self with the gospel of Christ. The gospel of self says, how can I best express myself? Whereas the true gospel says, how can I best reflect the character of Christ? The gospel of self says, what's in it for me? The gospel of Christ says, what's in it for God's glory? Self says, what do I like? The gospel of Christ says, what is God like? And what does he like? And the gospel of self says, what is most fulfilling to me? Whereas the true gospel says, what is most faithful to God? Can you see, at the outset, this half-truth seemed so tame and innocuous, didn't it? Just a small half-truth, and yet the outcome is so diametrically opposed to the true gospel. Mark Sayers shows how wildly radical this way of living is these days. To be shaped by grace in a culture of self is the most countercultural act one can commit. To break its only taboo, to commit self-disobedience. To acknowledge that authority does not lie with us, that we ultimately have no autonomy. To admit that we are broken, that we are rebellious against God and his rule. To admit that Christ is ruler. To abandon our rule and to collapse into his arms of grace, to dig deep roots into his love. That's the gospel of Christ. Paul says it like this in 2 Corinthians 4. If our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this age has blinded the minds of the unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Can you see that haziness, that distortion, when we turn from the source of all light, God, and bend in on our shadows? Paul carries on, for we are not proclaiming ourselves but Jesus Christ as Lord and ourselves as slaves because of Jesus. You see, life is not primarily about finding ourselves or creating our true selves. It's about God opening our eyes to who we really are and living in light of that. I want to conclude by going back to a garden, not the Garden of Eden where we find Eve, but the Garden of Gethsemane. In it, we find a man sweating blood. In about as much personal turmoil as any human being could be in. This was a man that had never lied to himself nor anyone else. In that sense, he was always true to himself. And yet here in this garden, his own legitimate desires to flee pain and to escape an agonizing, unjust death, ran headlong into his father's will. Father, if there is any other way, please take this cup from me, he prays. And then, yet not my will, but your will be done, Father. And he sets his sights on Golgotha. In the context of this message, was Jesus denying himself, dying to himself in this garden? Absolutely. And it was agony for him. But through it, he was not being less true, nor less himself. But in fact, he was becoming the greatest version of himself and the best version of humanity that ever was. In denying himself, he reflected the truest version of himself. I began this message by saying that many non-Christians might find Christianity suppressive, repressive, regressive, and that it sometimes might require us to deny ourselves. But the opposite is really true, isn't it? It's as we die to our fallen old selves and their desires when they come into opposition with God's will that we discover who we were always meant to be, that we become who we were born again to be, who Jesus died to see us raised again to be. Friends, it's not by trying harder that we get to be truer to ourselves and become the best versions of ourselves. It's by believing this gospel more, letting it sink in deep, deeper than the half-truths of our culture. It's as we turn from trying to find our salvation and enlightenment by looking inside us, unbend ourselves and bask in the source of all light and life, that we become truly who we were always meant to become. Can I ask that we pray? In reflection, we're going to sing a song together. But as I was preparing, I really felt like there's a lot of people that are in a Garden of Gethsemane moment in their life, where being true to God feels agonizing in the season of your life. For others of us, it might just be a small change where we feel like we need to be more other-centered or start with God instead of ourselves when we are embarking on our lives in this next week. And wherever you are, why not, while we sing this song, say in your own words the prayer that was prayed in that garden. Father, not my will, but your will be done. And as we do that and as we sing this song, let's pray that God would do what only he can do. That he would peel off the layers of the false self, the egotistical, narcissistic tendencies that we all have, the self-obsession, the self-preoccupation, and that we would join in into a freedom that is real liberty, the freedom of self-forgetfulness and God-awe. God, we want this for our lives. We turn from ourselves, from our inward focus, and we unbend to bask in you and your all-sufficiency. Thank you for who you are and who we are in you. Amen.